Last time, we talked for a moment about renormalization techniques in one dimension. This time I'm going to start out talking about renormalization techniques in two dimensions. So I start out with this lattice in two dimensions. And I imagine dividing the lattice up into boxes, as shown here. Each box contains 9 spins. Each box is 3 times as big as the distance between the spins to begin with. What we're trying to do is calculate once again the trace of the exponential of an Ising model, Hamiltonian, which has nearest neighbor interactions, magnetic field interactions, that is on-site interactions, represented by a K and an H. Now what we're really trying to do is understand what happens, how this result changes as we go from a situation in which we have a lattice constant this big to a lattice constant which is 3 times as big. How we work with fewer degrees of freedom and how we do a renormalization into blocks. Imagine that each box in the picture has in it a new Ising variable called mu r. Mu r is takes on the values plus or minus 1, where the R's are at the center of each of these blocks. These blocks, these R's have a lattice separation 3 times A. Each new variable is tied to an old variable because the new variable, mu R, is some function of the old variables. For example, and this is the example I'd like you to think about, the new variable might be the given by the direction of the sum of the old variables, these spin variables, and then take on the value plus or minus 1, pointing in the same direction as the majority of the spins in this block. We define this capital G, which is going to describe our renormalization, to be a product of small g's, one for each block, and each small g obeys the condition that if we sum it over the new variable, we get 1. Therefore, the sum over all of the new variables of this thing is 1. Therefore, if we define E to some function of the new variables, which is the sum over all the old variables of G of mu and sigma, all the new variables, all the old variables, e to the minus beta H of the old variables. It is automatically true because of this condition and this condition that not only is Z the sum over sigma of E to the W of sigma, it is equally true that it is the sum over mu of E to the W prime of mu. I have therefore defined a new problem with new variables which has exactly the same answer as the old problem but answers a different question. The old problem is what happens on a lattice with a lattice constant A, The new problem is what happens on a lattice with lattice constant A prime, and the answer is going to be the same in both cases. We then have two different representations of the same problem, which give the same answer, but are nonetheless different. If we could ask our fairy godmother what we would want out of this W prime, well, we started out with a W which depend on a coupling and a magnetic field. Our desire in life might be to have a W prime which depended on some new coupling, nearest neighbor coupling, and new magnetic field. If we could have that, and we could know how the new coupling and magnetic field depended on the old coupling and magnetic field, we would be all done. We would have effectively a solution to our problem. I'm going to let you stare at this for a minute, because it is a reformulation, which is different in kind from the formulations that you learned about as undergraduates. As undergraduates, you learned how to solve problems like calculate the partition function. Here, it is not a question of solving a problem, it is a question of replacing the old problem by a new problem which has exactly the same answer. This is a new point of view on what we should be doing. Yes, please.
So the new coupling is in between the lattice points at the center of each box.
Yes. So the new coupling is supposed to be, so this is supposed to be of the form e to the minus beta times, call it h prime, and h prime is supposed to be the sum over nearest neighbors, new nearest neighbors, mu r prime times a new coupling plus a new magnetic field, the sum over r, mu r. This is a little bit too much to hope for, of course. On the other hand, let us pretend that it is true and see what happens. Let's make this as an ansatz, an assumption for what might be going on, and then see what conclusions we could reach from that assumption or ansatz. So what we have done is let the lattice constant go into a new lattice constant, which is three times as big. We have let the old value of e to the minus beta h go into a new value of e to the minus beta h, which is described by a new coupling and a new magnetic field. As we did that, our construction guaranteed that the partition function did not change. However, as we did that, the couplings did change, the new couplings, the new value of k is some function of the old value of k. Now, this is not entirely unreasonable as a thing to do. The reason that it's not entirely unreasonable is that we're looking at the behavior near the critical point. And at the critical point, the behavior of the Ising model is scale invariant. That is, if we look at it on this length scale, or we look at it on this length scale, or this length scale, we always see the same behavior. The way of saying that is that the characteristic length scale, which we called C last time, goes to infinity when K goes to KC. If there's no characteristic scale, of course, changing from A to A prime won't change much of anything, and that we could describe the same problem then in this new way and get the same sorts of answers. In any case, I proceed in a straight line on the basis of the assumption that we can describe the new problem in terms of a new coupling, K prime, and that if the old coupling is close to the critical value, that is, it is the coupling at the critical point minus a small deviation that I call T, then the new coupling will be close to the critical value. It's the value at the critical point minus a small thing, which I will call T prime. T prime is not equal to T, but it is related to T. Once you have accepted line 3 and roughly the same thing about magnetic field, H prime is going to be equal to we start out with a small h, we're going to end up with a small h prime. You have swallowed the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker. Once you've swallowed that, you're going to have all the properties near the critical point laid out right in front of you. So it's all happened up to there. If the old problem is at the critical point, then the new problem is at the critical point. So if T is 0, T prime is 0. If you're in the ordered region, that is T less than 0, then the new problem is in the ordered region. If you start out in the disordered region for T greater than 0, you go into the disordered region. If T is small, then the new value of deviation from the critical point will also be small. If you start out close to the critical point, you'll end up also close to the critical point. In fact, you then have a linear relationship between, or one guesses, a linear relationship between the old value and the new value. The coefficient here depends on the ratio of new coupling to old coupling. I will write it as new lattice constant to old lattice constant raised to the power y, and that will define y. If I did a numerical calculation looking at the new problem and looking at the old problem, I could indeed figure out what the value of this coefficient is and the value of y. People have done that, this is a reasonable thing to do according to their numerical work. Let's see what the consequence then is for the coherence length. C is a physical quantity, like the partition function. As a physical quantity, it doesn't change as we change our description of the problem. It doesn't change when we go from A to A prime. So if we write the coherence length as some number times a lattice constant times T minus TC to the power nu, this thing is proportional to T minus TC. This is a reasonable way of writing it. First of all, we have phenomenological work, measurements of behavior near the phase transition, which fit this form. Secondly, we know that the coherence length goes to infinity as the system approaches criticality. And so if nu is positive, this is a reasonable thing to do. If we look up the Onsager solution of the two-dimensional Ising model, that has nu equals 1. If we do experiments and measure the coherence length in a three-dimensional Ising model, then we find nu is 0.64. Yes, excuse me, I've just struck that life is hard here. Please.
Just to clarify something, the k we are referring to here, is it delta times the k that appears in the Hamiltonian?
Yes, or rather, not quite exactly. The notation that I use is that there's an energy J times sigma r prime. And that's what's really in the Hamiltonian. However, I'm always going to be talking about minus beta h, so that's minus beta times j. K is minus beta times j, which is j over kt with a minus sign, and that's Boltzmann's constant. Okay? Please.
On the slide, in comparison to the notes, you have a sign difference where you have k equals kc minus d and on here you have plus d, and you have less than 0 versus greater than 0 for t. So, like, can you explain a bit what that's about and what exactly all that t is?
Okay. Temperature minus critical temperature over critical temperature, as defined here with a positive sign. Defined in the notes, it has a negative sign. It's minus the temperature, minus the critical temperature. Since, first of all, you've got to recognize that physics is a human creation. I can write whatever I want there. I put a plus sign or a minus sign or a minus 3. That's just a definition, a small t. To fit what I do in the seventh and eighth part, I changed the sign here as I worked over the lecture notes last night. since I invented this notation, not now, but 40-odd years ago, since I invented this notation, I have a perfect right to change it if I want to. This corresponds more closely to what I did in 1965, and that's why I changed it to look like this. The notes, as you get them, are rough. I often find errors in things which are slightly, and change things. I don't find so many errors. You all will find more for me. But in any case, this sign is strictly a matter of definition. And I define it now so that the disordered, the ordered region is t less than 0. And I define what I said in the notes was quite correct. If you make the other choice of sign, then you make the other choice of inequality. Okay, we go along. If t is small, t prime is bt. That is, t prime is proportional to t, where this b is something that we can measure experimentally or in a computer simulation. However, we want the coherence length to be some number times the lattice constant to give it the right dimensions of a length to times the deviation of criticality to a power. This I did not invent. This is the result of experience with series expansions of the kind I talked about last time, or experiment, or a good guess as to what it might be to have a coherence length which goes to infinity as you go to the critical point. So I start from there and then point out that the two-dimensionalizing model has nu equals 1. I know that exactly because I read Ansager's paper, and I know from Ansager's paper how the coherence length diverges. And I know from looking at series expansions how the three-dimensionalizing model goes. Now, if this is going to be true, and if this is an equally good expression for the very same coherence length, that is some number times a new lattice constant times the new value of the deviation from criticality raised to the power minus nu, then I get a expression from here and from here. I get an expression, I get a result from these two things which tell me what nu is. It is, in fact, has the value 1 over y. So this is my definition right here. This is an experimental number or number from series expansions. I now know what the value of this quantity that I defined is. I'm going to go through and look at a few more quantities. The number of lattice sites is the volume of the system divided by the lattice constant to the dimension of the system. In the new representation, we have fewer lattice sites. We have fewer degrees of freedom. It is the same old volume, the same physical quantity, divided by the new lattice constant raised to the dimension of the system, so that the ratio of these two is going to be the ratio of these two things raised to the power d. Now, the free energy, first of all, is proportional to the volume of the system. That's always true. Bigger systems give us bigger free energies. The free energy is proportional to the number of lattice sites or to the volume of the system. It is proportional to the number of lattice sites times some function of the deviation from criticality. There are non-singular terms, terms that don't do anything exciting in the free energy that I'm not going to worry about. However, I'm going to worry about a term which is proportional to the number of lattice sites times a singular part of the free energy, because that singular part of the free energy is going to end up giving me the specific heat. Specific heat, that is the heat capacity per unit volume, is proportional to the second derivative of the free energy per unit volume with respect to T minus TC, or the heat capacity of the entire system is proportional to the second derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature. This, from the statement that the free energy in the old representation is going to be the same as the free energy in the new representation, we then find that the free energy is proportional to the deviation from criticality to the dimension of the system times nu. That's just the same argument as we did for the coherence length, now applied to the singular term of the free energy. And so we know how the specific heat behaves. It diverges as a T to the dy, to the dy minus 2, since then you're taking two derivatives of T to the dy. So the form of the singularity in this thermodynamic quantity is determined by this coefficient that I started with at a third of the way down the slide. I'm going to come back to this. I'm going to talk about this in part 7 and part 8 of these lectures. What I should be saying now is that this argument, in which one starts out and talks about how the deviation from criticality changes in T minus, in how the deviation of K from criticality changes, how the magnetic field changes as we change the value of the lattice constant. This argument then gives, in a phenomenological way, I'll explain what the word phenomenological means in a moment. This argument gives, in a phenomenological way, all of the behavior near the critical point in terms of the coefficient, which tells you how the deviation from criticality in the coupling constant and in the magnetic field behave. Two coefficients, two values of y, all the thermodynamics and things like the coherence length, fully determined at least the way the powers work. Now, it says here at the bottom of the slide that what we have here is not a complete theory. Well, there are two things I should say. First of all, that relations like the relations that I get all of the critical indices in terms of two indices determined in this fashion, that was actually figured out first by a chemist by the name of Benjamin Whittem, published in J. Chem Phys. This argument here is the argument that I devised, which explains Whittem's result. It is called a phenomenological theory because we have no way of determining this coefficient y except going to experiment or series expansion or other numerical techniques. There are two such indices, one for the coupling constant k, the other for the magnetic field. Those two indices determine everything, but it's not a complete theory because we have no way of determining from this those two indices. It is also not a complete theory because I asked my fairy godmother to give me something. I asked my fairy godmother to give me the idea that in the new problem, the new problem could be described in terms of a new coupling constant K prime and a new magnetic field H prime. Fairy godmother delivered that for the one-dimensional Ising model. Fairy godmother may not have delivered it for the two-dimensional Ising model. We'll have to go back and talk about the extent to which it's been delivered. But now I can talk about the problem once more. As you recall, when we did the one-dimensional problem, we started out with a line of couplings, and we started out from very strong couplings on the right-hand side of the line, and then we step-by-step renormalized the couplings, doing the change from K to K prime. K prime is some function of K. As we did that step by step, the couplings got weaker and weaker and weaker until they ended up at zero strength. We then said every problem was like the problem in which particles are weakly coupled together. We then said that all of these problems are equivalent to a weak coupling problem, and we got a simple answer. The phenomenology of the two-dimensional Ising model is different. We start out maybe from couplings that are just above the critical point. What happens then is the couplings, instead of getting weaker and weaker and weaker as they go in one dimension, they get stronger and stronger and stronger until when we are at coupling strengths just larger than the critical coupling strength, when we are at values of K just larger than KC, after many, many renormalizations, we get to a very strong coupling problem in which the sigmas are coupled to each other very strongly, and the magnetization has a well-defined direction. Conversely, if we start out, zero means our starting point, just below the critical point, the coupling gets weaker and weaker and weaker in this two-dimensional problem until we eventually reach infinitesimally weak couplings. So that there are two possible destinations. One is strong couplings, the other is weak couplings. These two possible destinations, as drawn by the arrows there, are the two things you can have as the usual behavior of the two-dimensional Ising model. Either the thing is a ferromagnet and behaves as if its couplings is very strong, or it is what is called a paramagnet and behaves as if its couplings are very weak. There's only one further possibility, that you start out exactly at the critical point, and then, as you can see from what I say here, you stay at that critical point, and you have a behavior which is neither paramagnetic nor ferromagnetic. These behaviors at coupling zero and coupling infinity are said to be stable fixed points. The system flows into them and sticks at them. This behavior at coupling equal to the critical value is an unstable fixed point. There it is right there. It's an unstable fixed point, and if you start out just a tiny bit away from that, the system moves away from it. This is an analogy with what happens in dynamical systems. That's an, well, if I could balance it, it would be an unstable fixed point, whereas that's a stable fixed point. And that's what these systems are supposed to be doing. Back up. Okay. I put this in at this time in the course so that there would be a mixture of things which most of you had seen before and things which most of you have not seen before. I'm not quite sure whether or not you all have seen this argument. You probably haven't seen it in exactly this form. This thing, well, it's up there before when I mentioned Kramers and Vanier. It is a picture of fireworks. These are not the fireworks of the United States' 4th of July. These are intellectual fireworks, exciting things that excite the mind and bring us something that is interesting and unexpected. This picture in which a fixed point, in which the critical point is an unstable fixed point, and weak coupling and strong coupling are stable fixed points. This picture is one of our examples of a tremendous achievement in physics. I can say that clearly, because although the arguments before were mine, this picture is certainly not my invention. And it gives you a very good way of understanding what happens in the neighborhood of critical points. I'm now going to switch topics. I'm going to start out talking about what happens when we look at the dynamics of various systems. I asked you to believe something. Most of you are willing to believe it. I asked you to believe that for equilibrium systems, systems which had settled down to an equilibrium behavior, the probability of finding some behavior or another was proportional to e to the minus beta h, and that this h then depended on the variables of the problem. This was an ansatz, an assumption about the equilibrium critical behavior. And most of you, either because you had heard it in a course before or because that you're nice people and willing to believe things, were willing to accept this. I, however, didn't give the slightest argument for it, not the tiniest. I am now going to spend several lectures in which I describe arguments, in fact, the original arguments, for believing that something like this was true. These arguments have to come not from statistical physics, not from statistical mechanics, but have to come from the dynamical behavior of systems. The idea is that the dynamics, the motion of the various systems, are going to lead to to a probability of this form, and that we should want to have some derivation of the probability in precisely this form. Now, there are major intellectual problems in this derivation. We will see the problems as they develop. However, I'm going to start out with stuff which doesn't have much in the way of intellectual problems, stuff which we can then follow and see what is happening. Please do.
What is the sign of KT?
KT is always positive. K is number 1.6 times 10 to the minus 16 ergs. Oh, KC. It's both, as a matter of fact. The critical value of the coupling, there are two values. One here, KC being positive. This is a line that goes from coupling 0 to coupling infinity. Somehow the infinity didn't get put in there. And that gives us a situation in which all the spins line up. However, if you put in a negative value of the coupling, that's just the same sort of problem in which the spins want to anti-align. Nearest neighbor spins will then anti-align.
So is that what you call the dipolar region?
No, that's what I call an anti-ferromagnetic region. Let me see whether I can draw. Thank you for asking the question. It's a very good question. And one that needed to be asked. Ferromagnet. Mostly it's ordered with a few spins maybe out of line. But mostly everything's ordered up this way. This is a ferromagnet. There are materials called anti-ferromagnets, which are just exactly the same as ferromagnets, except backwards. So let me draw you a backwards. This spin is up, the neighboring spin is down, this one is up, the neighboring spin is down, this one is down, the neighboring spin is up, this one is down, oh no, this one is out of whack. This is the one that's crazy. And the neighboring spin is going to be up, and then up, down, up, down. This is an anti-ferromagnet. With a few exceptions, all of the spins fall into a pattern. In the ferromagnet, the pattern is that the spins point the same way. In the anti-ferromagnet, the pattern is the spins point opposite to its neighbors, and then there is a disordered system. These two are ordered. Then I do the disordered system, and that spins point every which way as they... I can't do every which way so easily, but they point every which way just as at random. At high temperatures, at high values of T, the system is disordered because there's the coupling K is much bigger than 1, K is much less than minus 1, K in magnitude is much less than 1. Or KC, which is of order 1. I've forgotten exactly what it is in the two-dimensionalizing model, but it's a number of order 1. Ferromagnet has all the guys lined up because the strong coupling is trying to push them to be lined up. Anti-ferromagnet has them anti-aligned because the coupling is strong but with the opposite sign, is trying to push them to be aligned opposite to one another, and disordered system that things point every which way. You know, okay, no, that's, I think that's enough. Further questions? Yes, please. I think okay. And this is a question which has a sort of different answer in particle physics and condensed matter physics. Let me give you the condensed matter physics answer first. In condensed matter physics, we start out from a system in which we think about it as being a system of atoms or molecules. So each one of these guys is the spin on, say, an atom of iron or an atom of nickel. This distance is a distance which in the old-fashioned units that I use is of order of an angstrom or so, or the order in the newer units, which you all should be using, is of the order of a tenth of a nanometer. This distance, which we call A, is fixed at that tenth of a nanometer. Now we have a hunk. Aha, that's a hunk of nickel. Well, it isn't really, but let's pretend that it's a hunk of nickel. This distance right here includes 10 to the 8th of these distances. Big, big, big. This is a big, big distance from the point of view of the atomic system. If we want to understand the properties that we see in a piece of iron or nickel, we want to understand it on our human scale. And so what we want to do is go from an understanding on a scale A to an understanding on a scale of 1 centimeter. That's our human scale. And one way of thinking about it, this is sort of trivial. At the atomic scale, we simply have Coulomb forces, pretty much nothing else, and the Schrodinger equation. Nothing else to think about. We can write the Schrodinger equation down on blackboard, and maybe we're all done. However, we're not all done. We have to explain pictures like this. Without a considerable amount of work, we do not understand why the spins in iron and nickel line up with each other, and the spins that exist in a piece of gold do not line up with each other. That requires a careful argument going from this scale to that scale. Furthermore, we have to understand qualitatively what this lining up might be. This renormalization argument, which is depicted graphically here, is an argument which tells us how we understand what happens on the macroscopic scale from what we understand to happen on the the microscopic scale. That's how a condensed matter physicist will explain it to you. Let me have another 2 minutes, and then I'll come back to your question. May I please? A particle physicist will say it to you, will tell it to you somewhat differently. Particle physicist would say our job is to take the data that comes out of, say, the Large Hadron Collider or other accelerators, and infer from that the microscopic behavior that we might see in quantum chromodynamics or at the Planck scale or in the very tiny, tiny, tiny scale at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. In both cases, the job is to go from one scale to another. In fact, that's the major subject of this entire year that you're spending here. Your year is spent on understanding how you go from physics on one scale to physics on another scale. I have just given you a sort of oversimplified version of a tiny piece of that. Now, please, back to you. You got it. It's just like if I lean this a tiny bit this way, it'll fall that way. And if I lean this a tiny bit that way, it'll fall that way. And if I let it, if I try to make it stand up straight, and I'm very successful, it may stand up for a while.
But our system should be the same. Why the theory looks so different?
The system is almost the same here and here, but not exactly the same. Just as a little boy embryo is almost the same as a little girl embryo, but not exactly the same, and they develop somewhat differently. As you look on a larger and larger length scale, you can better and better see the tiny differences between there and there. However, you know what I just told you. You take a pot of water, and you heat the pot of water up to 99 degrees centigrade. It's just a pot of water sitting there hot. You heat it to 101 degrees centigrade, and the whole thing evaporates and goes off into the air. This tiny change makes a huge difference. That's precisely this kind of difference. That's what this is for. This idea that a tiny change can make a huge difference is something to expand your mind, and our whole job here is to expand our minds. Okay, now to an entirely new topic, we're going to talk about hopping. Not entirely new, because I'm just going to continue to talk about what happens to a system, a condensed matter system. That's my subject. That's how I explore the world. I think about condensed matter systems and try to use it to understand what is happening in the world. So I think once more about a system which contains a bunch of lattice points. this might be a system, a hunk of gold, gold crystal, and there might then be an impurity that hangs around near one of those gold atoms. And after a while, that impurity gets some energy from the phonons that are in the system and hops to a neighboring spot. And that sits there for a while and gets some energy and hops to another neighboring spot. And so on and so forth, the impurity moves through the whole system. We're going to be spending some time talking about the physics of a particle moving in a solid. Often this motion occurs as a set of discrete hops. The particle gets stuck someplace, sits for a while, acquires some energy from the phonons around it, hops free, gets caught in some trap, and then sits for a while. I'm going to describe the mathematical idealizations of this motion, discrete hopping on a lattice, and as another idealization, continuous random motion. One point is to see the difference between the two different topologies of discrete hopping on a lattice and continuous random motion. Often one approximates the other, one by the other, and lots of modern physics is involved approximating the discrete thing by the continuous thing and vice versa. There's a fine old tradition to this. Boltzmann hated continuum problems and described everything he possibly could in terms of discrete systems. In particular, when he wanted to talk about e to the minus beta times the energy, he imagined that the energy was divided into very small discrete pieces and talked about small changes in energy. A little bit later, Planck and Einstein talked about this kind of quantization in a more realistic and real way because they had quantum mechanics. They were inventing quantum mechanics and inventing the discretization of energy. So our lattice is a group of sites arranged in a regular pattern. For example, here is such a group of sites arranged in a regular pattern. The particular lattice that I show here, if we include all of the guys, R at n1, n2, and any other integers up to n sub d times the lattice constant, this collection of points where the n's are integers is called the hypercubic lattice. There are other lattices of other kinds, which we'll talk about a little bit from time to time. We're going to develop the concept of a random walk, hopping from one site to another on a lattice like this. This is sometimes called a drunken walk. We could do this in any number of dimensions. However, we'll approach this in the simplest possible way by working all out in one dimension and then stating results for higher dimensions. A random walk is a stepping through space in which the successive steps occur at times t is some integer, capital M, times tau. I should point out that this part 4 of the work is relatively easier than any of the other parts. And so this is a sort of time to relax. What I did in the last part was real hard, and what I'll do in successive parts will be hard also. But this is sort of easy. One easy thing is that we imagine that we have a position on a one-dimensional lattice. So let me draw the one-dimensional lattice. There's a one-dimensional lattice. And we start out someplace. Start out right there. And after a while, after a time tau, we hop to a neighboring site. We either hop this way or this way. 50-50 probability that we will hop in either direction, and that's what this says here. x of t is the position. X of t plus tau is the position at a time tau later. It is the position you started with, plus a lattice constant, the distance between there and there, times sigma j. This is the jth step we're talking about. And sigma j is another Ising variable, which takes on values plus or minus 1. In this case, we're going to think about situations in which the average of sigma j is 0. We're going to think about situations in which we have a bunch of successive steps. So sigma j times sigma k is equal to 0 if j is different from k, and equal to 1 if j equals k. That's done by saying that this average is delta jk. Delta jk is 1 if j equals k, and 0 if j is different from k. And we will then say sigma j squared equals 1, since sigma j is plus or minus 1. And I guess the next slide has on it what we get for the random walk. We represent the walk by two integers, m, the number of steps taken, and n, the displacement from the origin in lattice constants after m steps. We start from n equals 0 at m equals 0, and then we get n is a sum from k equals 1 to m of sigma k. Notice that n is even if m is even, and odd if m is odd. We'll have to keep the track of this property later on, I think. So what we get is that the actual position in physical space is xj x of t. If we start out at t equals 0 from at x equals 0, we end up with x of t is a lattice constant times the sum from j equals 1 to n sigma j. We're going to talk about the properties of this lattice, of this walk. These properties are relatively easy. I think we will start on them next time. I have another lecture to give today over at Waterloo University, and I want to keep a little bit of breath for the next lecture. So this will be a good place for us to stop. I will pick up here and start to talk about the positions and the probabilities of different positions. Next time, tomorrow. We will then go on to Einstein's calculation of the properties of a walk in both position and momentum. In 1905, Einstein did, as you know, three great pieces of work. One of those three great pieces of work was about random walks and about the motion of what are called Brownian particles, little particles of stuff suspended in a fluid and visible under the microscope. Through his study of Brownian particles and other things of that kind, Einstein helped show, basically was probably the most important person in showing, that the atomic theory of matter was correct. Before 1905, one could argue that atoms were a fiction that some people believed in, but that you didn't have to believe in. By 1920 or so, if you didn't believe in that fiction, you were pretty silly. And most of that was due to Einstein. And one of the arguments is one that we will follow carefully, which will have to do with random walks in both position and momentum. However, we will pick that up, probably begin on Friday, and then pick it up after Thanksgiving next week. In any case, I'm going to ask whether there are questions now and break. Questions, comments? Okay, great, thank you.
So the short answer was there.